to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Laveau. On March 4, 1865, 140 years ago this month, Abraham Lincoln delivered his second inaugural address. It was only 700 words long, but it was hailed then and has been seen ever since as not only Lincoln's finest speech, but also one of the great public addresses in American history. We'll be discussing Lincoln's second inaugural address this week with historian Ronald White. After that, Fiona Beatty will tell us about a website that includes the text of Lincoln's second inaugural address, as well as a large collection of related documents. And for our commentary of the week, Andrew Caton will offer us his thoughts on Americans' attitude toward war. But first, as we do each week, let's take a look at an article of historical interest in the news. His second term has only just begun, but historians are already grading President George W. Bush, and as you might expect, their assessments vary. The editors of Newsweek magazine asked six historians to judge Bush's performance. Robert Dalek ventured that historians would focus on Bush's reaction to 9/11 and the Iraq War. "I think they'll criticize him for not returning at once to Washington, D.C., Dalek said, but conclude that in the long run he responded fairly well to the attack on September 11th. With Iraq, he continued, it's difficult to imagine that historians will give him anything but poor marks. Richard Norton Smith believes that Bush will be seen as an important president, even though we don't yet know the long-term consequences of his policies, particularly his preemptive war in Iraq. Michael Beschloss was a bit more cautious, saying, if Americans in 2034 believe that with his boldness, Bush successfully used a moment of U.S. global preeminence to make the world more peaceful and democratic, he will probably do well before the bar of history. If not, he'll have a tougher time. And Doris Kearns Goodwin took a similar stance, explaining that it remains to be seen if Bush will be able to sustain our spirits if the war continues to defy the expected hope for victory. David Kennedy looked beyond the Iraq War to credit George Bush with being remarkably shrewd in his reading of modern U.S. history, where others, especially liberal Democrats, have misjudged the direction of the country and its essential nature. Where liberals dismissed evangelicals as the bourgeoisie and underestimated their size and power, Kennedy commented, Bush deserves credit not for pandering to them, but for honoring the authenticity of their beliefs and recognizing their electoral weight. Joseph Ellis agrees that George W. Bush's policies accurately reflect the core beliefs of the majority of the American public, that most Americans are socially conservative, and that many oppose abortion and gun control in addition to gay marriage. But, he concluded, 50 years from now, I suspect that Bush's position on gay rights will look as misguided as opposition to civil rights in the 1960s looks today. The complete text of these remarks can be found in the January 3rd issue of Newsweek magazine. This is Talking History. Thank you. Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address is one of the most remarkable public addresses in history, in its brevity and impact, its few words forever enshrined in the American memory. On this, its 140th anniversary, Talking History's Fred Nielsen discussed Lincoln's address with the author of a new book on the subject, Ronald White.
On March 4, 1865, 1 month before the end of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was inaugurated as president for the second time. Lincoln's speech that day, his second inaugural, was brief, only 700 words. In it, he explored the origins and meaning of the nation's bloodiest conflict and called for reconciliation, with malice toward none, with charity for all. Lincoln thought it his finest address, and my guest Ronald White agrees. White is a professor of American intellectual and religious history at San Francisco Theological Seminary and the author of Lincoln's Greatest Speech, the Second Inaugural. Professor White, welcome.
Delighted to be with you.
When Lincoln delivered his second inaugural, the Civil War was almost over, and we might expect a leader in that position, recently reelected and victorious in war, to enjoy the moment, to strut a little bit. Lincoln did not.
This is what his predecessors did. In preparation for trying to understand his speech, I read all of the previous second inaugural speeches, and really you could read the ones afterwards, and they have much the same tone. Feigned humility, but really quite a good bit of staccato of I. I am so grateful for what you have done in electing me. This would have been raised to a higher crescendo at this moment towards the end of the Civil War. And in fact, the Washington Daily Morning Chronicle that very morning said it's time for Lincoln now to express some vindication. He has been battered by press and critics. He needs to crow a bit.
How did Lincoln write his speeches?
Well, this is a fascinating story that needs to overcome at least one major myth. I'm amazed and surprised at how the myth of Lincoln writing his Gettysburg Address supposedly on the back of the flap of an envelope on the train to Gettysburg still persists. What I discovered in this book, but even more in my new book, The Eloquent President, is that Lincoln worked long and hard, slowly on his speeches. He had a method of writing notes to himself, which he filed either in his hat or in a desk drawer. He wrote a number of drafts of speeches, which we don't fully appreciate in the older collected works of Lincoln. In some instances, not too often, he would share these speeches with others, especially as president with William Seward, his Secretary of State, for critique. He would often revise right up to the last moment. Not that he hadn't written and revised before, but he would often arrive at a place. This was true at Cooper Union and at Gettysburg. He wanted to talk to people, listen to people, get the feeling of people, and then he would revise for a final draft.
What specifically was the genesis of the second inaugural?
Well, this is the harder one to discover. In most of his other speeches, indeed for most presidential speeches, you can find that someone has tried out a speech in Peoria or Poughkeepsie, and if it's played well there, it will find its way into an inaugural address or today in a State of the Union address. I discovered that the origins or the antecedents, really, of this speech are not to be found in his previous addresses, but in private letters, in correspondence, and then especially in one private memo that he never expected anyone to see. He wrote this memo kind of a musing or a reflection for himself. He stuck it in a drawer. It was found only after his death. And I think this is the most fascinating document. It really is the core or the foundation of the second inaugural.
And you're referring to his meditation on the divine will?
Yes. I don't know whether I would be all right to just read a little bit of this.
Please.
Say a little bit more about that setting.
Sure.
The North was looking forward, they thought, to winning finally the battle at Bull Run or Manassas in August of 1862, the second battle. But again, the Northern troops were surprised, this time by Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, and they lost a terrible defeat. Lincoln convened an emergency cabinet meeting, and Attorney General Edward Bates was there and recorded in his diary these words: "Lincoln seemed wrung by the bitterest anguish. Said he felt almost ready to hang himself." He didn't date it, but I believe that he wrote it on that day. He wrote these words: "The will of God prevails. In great contests, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be and one must be wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time. in the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party, and yet the human instrumentalities working just as they do are of the best adaptation to effect his purpose. A few more sentences go into this reflection, but I think this shows a brooding, contemplative president who was thinking about all these things privately and then somehow, for his own reasons, brought them forward publicly on March 4, 1865.
And that becomes one of the most remarkable things about the second inaugural, I think. He's on the verge of being able to declare a military victory, and yet he doesn't blame the South entirely for the war. Slavery caused the war, we all know that, he says, but all Americans are in some way responsible, and all Americans, North and South, in some sense, bear the guilt.
Yes, everyone in this crowd expected him, this heightens in any time of war, to demonize the enemy, in this case the South. They would have cheered if he did so. They even brought placards and banners that they had used in the election victory 4 months before. But what struck me in trying to understand the artistry of his words was Lincoln's use of what I call inclusive language. Over and over again, he uses the words all and both. All dreaded it. Both parties deprecated war. Then when he makes his shift from political to more theological language, he says both read the same Bible and pray to the same God. Lincoln is giving the best intentions to those who the crowd would have demonized as their enemy. This is part of the remarkable nature of this speech.
He missed an awful lot of opportunities for applause lines, didn't he?
He did. In fact, the New York Herald reporter said that there were only 4 occasions of applause. Think about that. Even though it was a short address, only 4 occasions of applause in the entire address.
Lincoln, we see this in the Meditation on the Divine Will, which you quoted earlier, and in the second inaugural as well, struggled to understand what had caused the Civil War and why it had continued so long and in such bloody fashion. Did he find an answer?
I believe he was still struggling for the answer, but it's important to note, first of all, how prominent slavery is in the second inaugural address. In recent years, we have had those people write that Lincoln did not really believe in the abolition of slavery, that this was simply a military move, a crassly move of a politician. But those charges have to contend with the fact that he spent so much time talking about slavery in the second inaugural. In fact, this is almost like a Puritan Jeremiad. By that I mean the Puritans in their sermons would have said, God has a cause against us, God has a complaint against us. And Lincoln, at this moment of high victory, dares, it's the most remarkable inaugural address of all in this regard, says, in the midst of victory, there is something terribly wrong in the American family, and it is this notion of slavery. Then secondly, again very surprisingly, he tries to find the answer for this problem, and he roots it in what he calls the Almighty has his own purposes. Lincoln uses religious language, but he uses it very circumspectly, never as if he absolutely understands what God is doing, but out of this brooding nature that somehow there are Almighty purposes here that we don't fully understand, but this is what is taking place.
Well, you make the point at several points in your book that what emerges from that is a kind of theological ambiguity, but also an inclusiveness, a God who includes everyone.
Yes, there is a kind of ambiguity, and this was again struck in the note of the Meditation on the Divine Will. It may be that God's purpose is different from the purpose of either side. He talks about judgment, but then he says, but let us judge not, quoting from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, that we be not judged. So although people would be quick to judge the South, he wanted to say in his inclusiveness, we are all responsible. He calls it American slavery, not Southern slavery, American slavery.
Lincoln is often described as a fatalist. Was he?
Well, this is another fascinating conversation. Yes, this term fatalism has been used by all of his major biographers, Stephen Oates in his fine 1977 biography, David Donald in his wonderful 1995 biography. But I think that there's a pretty fundamental misunderstanding if we try to ask what did 19th century people understand by fatalism. By fatalism, Lincoln sometimes used the definition, the doctrine of necessity. That is, that there are sort of certain immutable forces at work in the universe, and we are not really able to contend to go against those. The epigraph for David Donald's 1995 biography was, "I must admit that I have not controlled events." But what I discovered was, I think Lincoln was on a journey in which he was moving away from that fatalism towards what I would call providence. Again, historians have sometimes said, well, providence, fatalism, they're all on a single line of continuity. Not so. Francis Wharton, in 1859, who would become, after the war, one of the first professors at the Episcopal Seminary in Cambridge, across from Harvard, wrote a book in which he described fatalism as one of the heresies or skeptical theories of the day. And I think that Lincoln moved from fatalism, which was an impersonal force, to providence, which was a very personal God acting in history. This is the view that I think is expressed in the second inaugural.
Near the end of that speech, the beautiful last paragraph, Lincoln says, it's part of his call for reconciliation, that we must bind up the nation's wounds, care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan. Those are more than just beautiful generalities. Lincoln, you point out in your book, had some specific things in mind, including the care of the families of black soldiers.
I'm glad that you make that point, because the beauty of the words can carry us away, and we might think, well, Lincoln is simply a wordsmith here. But yes, there were very specific deeds that he wanted to accomplish. He discovered after one of the battles, the widow of a slain northern white officer came to him to tell him that she would receive a pension as the widow of an officer, but she discovered that all of the black soldiers who fell in this terrible battle, their widows would receive nothing because under the ethos of slavery, they were not officially married. And so Lincoln immediately wrote a letter to Charles Sumner that very afternoon saying, we must change this law. This woman is right. The widows of black soldiers must receive the same pension. So he had a program for how this reconciliation was going to take place. The question can be raised, could he bring it off? I think that it's a difficult question to answer, but I believe he was consolidating his own power, his own stature, and he had this kind of tough love approach where he could on one hand be tough, unconditional surrender, and yet on the other hand he was asking here for incredible deeds of reconciliation.
There's something of a paradox here. You point out that Lincoln quotes the Bible four times in a very short speech. No president had done that in an inaugural before him. Some of his listeners thought it more a sermon than a political speech. And yet, you conclude your book by writing that Lincoln offers little comfort for those who in every crisis or war want to chant, God is on our side. Lincoln, you continue, speaks forever against any God bless America theology that fails to come to terms with evil and hypocrisy in its own house. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, all historians, all writers know that you have several passes at a book, and I had my last pass at that epilogue about 4 days after 9/11. And I paused long and hard to think, do I really want to say this, as the nation now erupted in a kind of God bless America in a response to that terrible tragedy? I don't think that the two things that you're suggesting are incompatible. On the one hand, Lincoln was a student of the Bible. He read the Bible regularly. We've had a recent book on the soldier's home in which a journal of a Pennsylvania officer was discovered who would come to pick up Lincoln morning by morning to drive him from this sort of summer retreat to the White House. And he records that he would enter that house in the morning, and more often than not, he found Lincoln reading the Bible. Lincoln read the Bible. He memorized the Bible. He knew the Bible well. On the other hand, he knew the misuse of the Bible as well as the use of the Bible. He was very much put off by people who came to him, both politicians and clergymen, to tell him that God is on our side. And one time Lincoln literally sort of startled, said to them, I'm not so sure about that. What I want to discover is how I can get to be on God's side. So in a sense, picking up your comment also that this was a sermon, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist orator, was in the crowd that day. And that evening in his diary, he wrote down, this was not a state paper. This was a sermon. Well, if it was a sermon, then the first three paragraphs are, in a sense, the indicative. This is what God has been doing in judgment, but also in mercy. And the last paragraph is therefore, there's an unvoiced therefore, the imperative, what we should do. And what we should do is to live out, to bind up the nation's wounds with malice toward none, with charity for all, to care for him who's borne the battle. Lincoln understood that this would be the way, this would be, in a sense, the Christian benediction that would make our words become our deeds.
Well, Professor White, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm delighted to talk with you. Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Ronald White, the author of Lincoln's Greatest Speech, the Second Inaugural.
For our site of the week, following up on Fred Nielsen's interview with Ronald White, Talking History's Fiona Beatty directs us to a website where we can learn much more about Lincoln's second inaugural address.
Inaugural addresses are sometimes written for posterity, but when Abraham Lincoln wrote his second inaugural, little did he know that his words would echo through the ages and be among the American treasures posted for millions to see at the Library of Congress website. Artifacts and memorabilia from Lincoln's second inauguration are included as well. You can read how Lincoln doubted his re-election in 1864, revealed in a memo written in his own hand to cabinet members on August 23, 1864. This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be re-elected. Read the poem printed on a press in a wagon during Lincoln's inaugural parade on March 4, 1865, composed of 13 stanzas of laudatory verse, and click on the Previous Object button to go to Lincoln's first inaugural, March 4, 1861, where you will see photographs of crowds at the Capitol, as yet unfinished. 4 years later, at his second inaugural, Lincoln would stand before the completed dome and urge the restored Union to proceed with malice toward none, with charity for all. To find out more, go to www.loc.gov.
To conclude our program for this week, as promised, Andrew Caton offers us his thoughts on the ambivalence he sees in American attitudes toward war. Caton is Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University of Ohio and the author, along with Fred Anderson, of The Dominion of War, Empire and Liberty in North America, 1500 to 2000, published by Viking Press.
Americans are ambivalent about war. The fear of power justified our revolution, and we have enshrined choice as the foundation of our society. Yet Americans have used military power at least as frequently as any other people on earth. We do so in part because we believe our values to be universal values. Ever since the Revolution, Americans have insisted that we take up arms to liberate, not to enslave. That faith makes opposition to our efforts baffling. We see those who refuse to embrace our values as unreasonable, perverse, uncivilized. We offer the American Revolution, the Civil War, and World War II as proof that Americans fight only to defend liberty or advance its progress. And these conflicts did indeed create a republic, destroy slavery, overcome fascism, and encourage the civil rights movement. Yet by constructing our national story in this way, we inevitably relegate such smaller conflicts as the French and Indian War, the War of 1812, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, and the interventions of the 20th century to the footnotes. Other peoples, Indians, Mexicans, Filipinos, and Cubans, for example, do not see these conflicts as insignificant. Indeed, groups on the receiving end of American might wielded in the name of liberty have less often responded with gratitude than with resistance like that of American colonists confronting British imperial power in 1775. To recognize the dominion of war as shaping North America, and indeed the globe, is not to replace a triumphal narrative with a sordid one in which Americans are not only imperialists, but hypocrites. It is rather to argue for a complex narrative in which national values are dynamic and contested rather than fixed and immutable. Nothing has more powerfully compelled Americans to confront tensions between coercion and consent, between power and liberty, than America's wars. To grasp the importance of both empire and liberty in the history of the United States is thus to begin to understand, in a less naive, exceptionalist way, who we are as a people and how we stand in relation to the world as a whole.
You've been listening to Andrew Caton, co-author of The Dominion of War, Empire, and Liberty in North America, 1500 to 2000. Caton's commentary was recorded for Talking History at WMUB-FM at Miami University of Ohio. That's it for another week of Talking History. Once again, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. And that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu. Or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.